then.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
And good evening. This is Chippa Khan, and this is The New Normal on liveparanormal.com, where we try and make the weird and strange something a little bit more useful in your daily life than something clever to talk about at cocktail parties, because I actually don't know anybody who goes to cocktail parties. Our guest tonight is Ariel Malachi Sirocco, which is like a great name, who is an expert in the fields of Western mystical manifestation and energetics. He's a spiritual advisor, instructor, reverend, counselor, and founder of Coven Quiddity and the Akashic Temple. And so I'm going to stop talking and let him correct my pronunciation. Hello, Ariel.
Hello. How are you this evening?
I'm great. I always hate to mess up the pronunciation. How do you say Coven Quiddity?
Coven Quiddity. And you got it right on the nose. That's absolutely
good.
Strong. Yes.
And the Akashic Temple. And Akashic, we can remember. People here on Live Paranormal know about the Akashic records and things.
Oh, so. I'm absolutely sure.
And tonight we're going to be talking alchemy, which I think only students of history may know much about. How much alchemy is going on these days?
Well,
or not alchemy. No, we're not talking alchemy. I'm sorry, I'm mistaken. We're talking Hermeticism. Is it not? What's the relationship between those two?
Right. Well, the relationship between them, and we have to distinguish them really, really well, because there's Hermetism, and there's Hermetics. Alchemy happens to be a branch of Hermetics. Hermetics, let's say, is pretty much the religion, the process. Included in that is also sacred geometry, astrology, as opposed to Hermetism, which is actually the spirituality aspect, or let's call it the philosophical side of the whole craft or the art that we commonly refer to as alchemy.
So it's not the alchemy the way they have it in the alchemy department at MIT. Have you ever been to MIT?
No, I haven't.
Blows my mind. So this is the philosophical, and Hermeticism is the spiritual side, or is the
Hermetism.
Oh, I'm getting confused already. So,
okay. Hermetic, which is the word that we always hear, is actually the arts. It's the science. Okay. Included in the science, you have sacred geometry, you have alchemy, and that kind of thing. Now, in the philosophy side, you have Hermetism, and that's about the spirituality.
Okay.
When you talk about, let's say, the Nag Hammadi, you will read a lot of the spiritual in it. If you pick up the Corpus Hermeticum, though, which came into fashion during the Renaissance, what you'll find is a lot of the spirituality, yes, but by that time included, in order to pursue the spiritual, there was a lot of, let's call it, science behind the writing. So at that point, they had astrology or sacred geometry and metal alchemy or even plant. And you could practice those things, and a lot of folks did, obviously, and passed down the actual technical knowledge. But there is a different side to it because alchemy is supposed to be a symbolic practice. That's how it started out when it first developed back in ancient Babylonia, Sumeria, that kind of thing.
Well, it was the science that they had, and it
yes.
consisted of observing the universe and seeing patterns. So it now
Absolutely.
This is. Let me try and apply a person who doesn't know too much as to this. As I understand, an alchemy gives you a symbol set by relating to the world, so that if you see someone who has a lot of the same characteristics as the metal gold, then you can say they're a gold type person. If they have the same characteristics of unyieldingness, it's like iron, then you can,
yes.
you can say they're an iron kind of person. And if you have a person who looks like that is a tin type person and a person who is a brass type person, you put them together, they're going to have a bronze type relationship.
That's correct.
That's one way of looking at alchemy
actually,
that I. Oh, okay.
That's a really good way of looking at it. You have to remember, because what you just described right now sounds very, I'm sure it would sound very familiar to the listeners. They could turn around and go, oh, that sounds like astrology. Oh, that person is such a Leo, or she is such a Cancer, or that's completely Sagittarian. Absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, without even realizing it, they would be so correct that one could say that the modern astrological in its prototype actually consisted of just the seven major planets. And we acquired those characteristics, and then they kind of developed into something a little bit more larger. But it's exactly the same thing that you had described. If someone is mercurial, if someone is sulfuric, that kind of thing, or if someone's just, well, they're lead, you know. So you got it right on the nose.
Oh, good. I was trying to make sense out of it. But I understand the concept of symbol sets. A symbol allows you to say 20 things in one word or one symbol.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's how it actually had started. They needed to codify, they being the ancient Phoenicians, Sumerians, Eblins.
Ancient scientists.
Yes. They needed to codify this knowledge, understanding that it was so powerful because it described actually the way the universe worked. And in doing so, you have to remember that they saw the universe as above, so below. The universe was God. There was no difference. So in order to understand the divine, you use this set of symbols in order to kind of wrap your mind around it, you know? And in that way, yes, it needed more than one level, because any one practitioner who began this kind of study, you don't want to shut them off immediately by speaking way over their heads. So to each reader, to each student, there was a level of understanding that came along with time, and the more arts that they actually acquired, the deeper and wider the meaning would become, until they became a adapts.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense. I've seen this
absolutely
all over the place, and it's like people look at the world all different ways, and they all come up with the same conclusion. Would this relate, in your understanding, to how quantum physics is essentially saying the same thing as the magicians have been saying?
That is such. It's not even that what you're saying is a can of worms. It's just that particular section of this field of study has been blown open so wide now. There is most definitely a correlation between quantum physics and hermeticism and hermetics. In fact, if you go back to the Nag Hammadi and you start rummaging through it, or even the corpus, and you stumble upon, let's say, like book 2, and you begin to read it, there's certain things in there that are described that deity, the overall creator of the universe, of the material world, did. And you go, oh my gosh, that sounds so familiar. I understand that, but I understand that now as Newton's, that is Sir Isaac Newton's, law of motion, or gravitation, or quite possibly his works with light. It's photonic. And all of these things are designated by what's called the mind. Now, that's one of the most fantastical and yet real things that's actually happening in the world of hermetics right now, which is why I strongly follow the study of it, is that we are beginning to realize that there is a string of consciousness that goes through each and every level that actually connects the flesh consciousness or the material consciousness with that of the great divine. It's really just all one mind, or as they used to call it in ancient Greece, it's one nous. That's spelled N-O-U-S as opposed to N-O-O-S-E. And that's actually the connecting factor. That's why so many within the esoteric community and the occult groups have this phrase, as above, so below. Well, if that's true, then there has to be a bridge between the two stratas. And that bridge happens to be that of consciousness or that of mind. And there are many different religions throughout the entire globe that tout the philosophy that humankind was made in the image of deity, that we are the same. Well, obviously, deity, as far as we understand it, really doesn't have two legs and two arms and a head, nor does it really have a gender. That being said, then what is it that puts us in connection, or how are we like deity if it's not for our creative aspect through our own consciousness? That actually goes back to quantum mechanics in a very strong way. Because we're now beginning to understand that there's something called the observer effect. And how we view things, our own consciousness actually creates the reality around us. This was touted thousands of years ago. I mean, we're talking 3 or 4,000 BC. This stuff was beginning to get codified by the Phoenicians. And it's directly related to our higher technological advancements that's actually occurring now in the 21st century. As a matter of fact, I tell all of my students, what a wonderful time to be living in when all of this ancient wisdom is finally coming about and being not so much rediscovered, but being proved out. Our own intelligence is actually leading us back to what we once knew. And I don't want to sound Atlantean about it, but, you know, one could actually say that as well.
Now, you say students, and you've said we have discovered. So you're not the only one who's studying. You have students there.
Oh, no. There are plenty of guys and gals who are doing this, and from coast to coast and internationally. You have people such as myself, you know, college graduate. I've been around. I've read.
You're in the New York area.
What is it?
I was just saying you're in the New York area. I think New York City area.
Yes. Yeah.
But of course, thanks to the
New York
internet. So thanks to the internet, though, can reach everybody and. That must be helpful. God bless the internet.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. Actually, the internet itself, and I don't want to sound a little strange, but folks are beginning to study this too. The internet itself, as an organism, is actually developing its own consciousness, and it's actually helping us reach certain levels of intelligence that heretofore has never been achievable. People down in Texas, quantum mechanics students who are getting their doctorates are beginning to understand that hermetism and hermetics actually is the flip side, religiously speaking or spiritually speaking, to what they're studying in school, what they're getting their PhDs on, what they're getting their masters on. By the same token, we're also connected now to CERN, which I've been watching for quite a few decades. You know, I remember when the particle accelerators were here in Texas, and I remember when they decided to shut it down, and when the international contract went up to see who would get the bid. You know, but now we are connected to them, and they are moving forward in this discovery, in this new wave of not so much intelligentsia, because I think that the connotation for that is just that of knowledge as opposed to knowledge and wisdom. But in a way, it's actually increasing the vibratory frequency of the entire planet, that these people who are in the know, so to speak, and who want to be, can now connect to one another. And we're beginning to discover, we, meaning the esoteric community at large, are beginning to discover that everybody is throwing in a little piece. The scientists, the biologists, people like Bruce Linton, who is a cellular biologist who almost single-handedly brought into the world the study of epigenetics. Great man. And that plays into quantum mechanics, despite the fact that it deals with the body, because it deals with consciousness. And there's so many different levels that this goes in because it's all embracing.
Hmm. There's so much. Oh, one thing I wanted to go back to without interrupting you was you mentioned Nag Hammadi a couple times, and right. That it would be something that people could read, but I think we really ought to, for the people who perhaps don't know, mention texts are. You know, define them as this is a group of texts that were found in, was it 1945?
Very good, yes. Actually, in December of 1945, without getting into too much detail as to how they were found, because there's an adventure story along with that. But let me wind back the clock a little bit more, okay, before we get to the Nag Hammadi, to actually highlight how important it is. Throughout history, there has been a series of texts that that history chases, actually, and almost quite literally, history chases this particular text. Most people might be familiar with it if they've ever seen the movie The Secret, where in the beginning of the movie, there's a wonderful series of scenes where you see the scroll being passed down from person to person and being hidden and taken, and it survives floods and fires and everything like that, and it's referred to as The Secret. Well, actually, I can tell you what that is. That's actually portions of what was to be rediscovered during the Renaissance as the Corpus Hermeticum. But by that time, those particular papers have traveled so far and wide. I mean, it went from the Eastern Mediterranean all the way to Spain over several centuries and even more. So, of course, they were added to, they were edited somewhat, you know, pages were lost, sections were lost. But even so, when they finally made their way to Spain and actually brought about the golden age of Islam, they were kind of found again by the Crusaders. That brought them back to the middle of the Mediterranean and back to Florence eventually, where a few people, actually three people, found them. And this is where it gets fascinating. The folks who found them was none other than the three people who we can actually say began the Renaissance. That is, namely, Cosimo de' Medici, Leonardo of Pisa, and Marcello Ficino. And what had happened was that Leonardo of Pisa, he was a monk who was sent out by Cosimo, because Cosimo had an idea that he had wanted to build a library, and he sent Leonardo out to go through all the monasteries. Now, these monasteries were filled with texts that the Crusaders had brought back from various places, and most notably that of the Western Mediterranean, where there was writing there that we weren't privy to before. So Leonardo found something. He knew it was important because for some reason that I'm not quite sure of why, he understood that there was a series of philosophies and texts and scriptures that Plato and Aristotle and all of that crowd had drawn their philosophies from, and he knew that it was important. So did Cosimo. So Leonardo brought these texts back to Cosimo, and at the time, he actually had Marcello Ficino deciphering the divine Plato. And as soon as Cosimo saw the text that the monk had brought in, he actually asked Ficino to stop working on what he was doing. Stop transcribing divine Plato. Okay? Because what he had in his hand was actually this, the text, the tome, that we now refer to as the Corpus Hermeticum. But because that particular volume, those papers had traveled so far and wide, not only in distance but in time, it went through the normal wear and tear. So we actually had that, and that was well and good. You move history along, you have things like the Age of Enlightenment, you know, the scientific revolution, and then you have the Age of Romanticism, so on and so forth. And then you get to the Industrial Age, and then you kind of get to the Atomic Age. And this is where our story takes a left turn. And thank goodness. 1945, obviously, there was a world war going on. And in August, and I find this enormously fascinating, in August, August 6th and August 8th, the United States dropped two bombs. Now, we all know that the beginning of August is actually one of the high pagan holidays. It's called Lammas or Lunasa. And that is what's commonly referred to as the first of the sacrifices, meaning that it is the first harvest. And you begin to put yourself in tune with becoming winter. Even so, on August 6, 1945, and August 8, we dropped the bomb. Collectively, the world shuddered. And I can almost say that literally, because there have been tests conducted recently, like in the past 15 years, that have proven out that there is a global consciousness and that things do affect the world at large as a single organism. For the first time, humanity realized that we were capable of destroying ourselves. And that was a very cold awakening for us. We really did lose hope. And you have writers that actually describe that socially. You know, you get people like Jack Kerouac and so on. Ginsberg, you know. They understood what was going on, and they were just reflective of society at large. Hope was lost. We needed something. I find it enormously fascinating that in December of 1945, December of that very same year, the Nag Hammadi was found. Now, let's just take a look at the date, the time of year. December is the solstice. It is the return of the sun. It is the return of hope in many native traditions as well as neo-pagan ones. And it was at that time that we found something called the Nag Hammadi. About, if I remember correctly, it was about 60 miles south or southeast from Egypt itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what that was, what that is a much more complete text of the Corpus Hermeticum. Vastly more complete. Not only did it give us the missing pieces, or most of them, of the Corpus Hermeticum, but it also gave us a lot of what we may refer to now as the Gnostic Gospels, which actually fills out our understanding of Catholicism. Revolutionary find. And whereas the scientists working on the atom bomb may say that they were the destroyer of worlds, and I believe that one of them did. When this came around, scholars realized what they had, and they said, "This can be our salvation." There is such promise in the total sum of these texts that were found. That is the Nag Hammadi, and anyone who wants to pursue a spiritual life, a very wide one, I would definitely recommend picking up a copy of it. I mean, it's an ancestral read. It's a very important read.
Do you have a preferred version? I assume that if you go to a bookstore, they're going to be. It's translated.
Oh, there.
We don't read Coptic anymore, so.
Right. Yeah.
Is there a better version?
Do I have? If I'm not mistaken, the one that my wife and I share is the one from Cambridge Press.
Okay.
And that seems to be a very, very good one. There aren't that many editions out. It's not like the Corpus, where there are a lot of different editions. So the one from Cambridge seems to be the most accessible, and I would recommend that one. If someone wants to find out about the science of noetic alchemy, I would suggest the Corpus Hermeticum that's actually titled The Way of Hermes, which is a new rendition of it, and it is completely phenomenal. There are others that are good, and there are some that actually may be a little bit more complete, but the translations are not as good. That springs to mind immediately is going to be the one.
I just say, which book is it again? I'm asking what book.
Oh, the Corpus Hermeticum.
Corpus Hermeticum, okay.
But the translation that is titled The Way of Hermes. The Way of Hermes. And a number of different scholars got together in order to write that book. And the translation is very modern, and it takes into account that which we know in the 20th and 21st century, which makes it enormously accessible. And it just makes sense, you know. You can find other editions, but unfortunately, and this is something that had turned me off, because of the time that it was written in, it's enormously gender heavy towards the male. And I didn't appreciate that. The Way of Hermes makes it much more neutral, and I like that much, much more. That's not to say that hermetics or hermetism or alchemy doesn't have gender within its practice. Yes, it does. You know, you have the positive and the negative, the electrons and the protons. You know, you need to have that. You need to have the principle of polarity in order to distinguish between now and then. You know, but if you're going to read the corpus for its philosophical value, then I would suggest that you pick up The Way of Hermes. And as for the Nag Hammadi, Cambridge edition is pretty good.
Okay. Well,
But so you'll be reading that for a few months. It's a really thick book, you know, and it's very, very juicy and chewy.
Yeah, reading it for several months and maybe several years, if it's something that's going to affect your life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You can read it in several months, but to understand it and to put it into practice will take a little bit more than that. it'll take a while, you know.
But the short
game, Othello, you know, it takes minutes to learn and a lifetime to master.
Yeah. So it's like the short form is as above, so below. So, Tablet is the... I mean, I think everybody who, oh my God, I just remembered there was a wretched, wonderful movie with some mummy pulling out the Emerald Tablet from a and they had this big,
really?
Yes, yeah, and,
really?
And they had and smashing it or something, and I was like, oh my god,
no.
I got a tablet, and it's like you've got King Tut walking around with, like, oh my god. So it has at least bit of it reached popular fiction. But
yes, I was enormously happy. I was enormously happy when the movie The Secret actually did that right up front. It's so easy to bypass that and get to all the feel-good stuff without really having an understanding as to what one is doing, you know? Because a lot of folks, even though they did put that in the movie, a lot of folks walked away with, well, if I think it, it's done, which isn't necessarily true. There's a whole process to the noetic alchemy that needs to be subscribed to and followed, you know, and without having that internal work, it's just not enough to do a casual wish, which is unfortunate, but, you know, that's the way that it is, or else, you know, there'll be ice cream trucks on every block, I guess, you know, if people just wish the things and it happened. That being said, let me just throw something out. While I did like the movie The Secret, it does have a counterpart, and anyone who wants to go see The Secret or rent it, which is a great idea, mm-hmm. Should also see a movie called What the Bleep.
Oh, I love What the Bleep.
Which is the scientific version of The Secret, which is really, really great, you know. And you need both. You need both. You need to understand the mechanics of what's going on, which is described in What the Bleep, and you need to have an understanding of the philosophy of why you're doing it, which is contained within the movie The Secret. So that's really, really great. Now, a small thing about the Emerald Tablet was that you don't really need the aforementioned books to start your journey. You can actually get online and look up the Emerald Tablet and read those 14 stanzas and have a really good idea as to what it's saying and where the person should...
It's on Wikipedia. They've got a couple of versions on Wikipedia.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. One of my favorites actually happens to be the one from Sir Isaac Newton.
Yep.
I think that he did a very nice translation of it. Of course, I have my own. Choosing the best pieces of several. What is that?
That would be cool. That's like, of course you have, you know, everybody is going to say it in reflecting the way their lens on the world. I mean, this is how the world works, right?
Yes. Of course. I have a science background in bio, so I'm very particular with my words. And some of these versions use very good words, but they're words of that time in which these versions were written. And not that we know better, but we use words differently now. And in order to make it a little bit more succinct for our day and age, I went through the various versions, and I took that. And then where I saw where the words were a little loose, where we have a much more specific meaning to certain words, I replaced them with more modern words so that it's much more succinct, which is really, really great. But
Is this on a website somewhere that you have?
You know what? I should post it. I do have a website, www.theakashictemple.com. You can go and visit there. It's actually the portal to the school. And I have a calendar there of places where I do where I will be doing lectures. You can join the group there, the Yahoo group. You can find us on Facebook, so on and so forth. But I don't have a copy of our version of the Akash of the Emerald Tablet. That's a very good idea. I think I should.
I think
I may do that in the next day or two. Great idea. Thank you.
I like that idea.
Yes.
So yeah. You have. So it's technique then that I when I was a kid I read Jonathan Livingston Seagull, and I loved it when he said it's not enough to believe you can fly, you have to learn how to do it. And I think for me, that was the message of magic. It's like you have to learn out how to. Yeah, once you've accepted magic is real, that's a good first step, but then you have to learn how to do it. And,
Yes. For those that join the school, throughout the entire process, and at this point, I look at the class and I go, okay, all together now, and they know exactly what I want to hear. The novice knows what, the apprentice knows how, the master knows why, but only experience is the blind. It's not enough to understand the process, because without the experience of the process, you're not changing anything. And that's, you know, and whether it's easy or whether it's scary or whether you have to face your inner demons or, you know, evolve yourself, go outside the boundaries, you know, you go outside your comfort zone, as they say, you know, you have to get up and you do the work, you know. How terrible is wisdom when it does not profit the wise, you know, so you have to enact whatever it is. Absolutely, and there's a whole lot of internal work too.
Well, I was going to say you can want to do good to your fellow man, but if you don't actually get out there and, you know, hand over the food or the blankets or whatever they need,
right? Exactly. Yes. That's something that I try and instill in my brother Masons, and they all are receptive to it. You know, you have to go out and you have to do the good works. You know, we tout ourselves in saying that we take good men and we make them better, but it's not enough to say that and to gather in lodge and to share a cocktail or a cigar or whatever, you know, but you have to go out to the hospitals and you have to have a day there and help them out and do the volunteer work or clean up a park or whatever it is, you know? So, yes, but... alchemy is most definitely a process. Noetic alchemy even more so, because now not only are you going through the motions, but you're also internalizing them, and you're weaving your own fabric of reality in order to create the person who you need to become. It's the difference between karma and dharma. You know, all of us collect karma. Not all of us pursue our dharma. And that's really one of the ideas behind noetic alchemy, is to actually to bring yourself, to give birth to yourself, very, very much the same way that the Phoenicians believed, from which we get the idea and the word phoenix, rising from the ashes, which is enormously alchemical, you know. It's the rebirth process, which and that idea has been handed down time and time again. All of our heroes go through this process of different stages of the adventure in order to become a new person, you know, and that's what noetic alchemy is talking about. But it gives you a guide, a symbolic guide on how to travel that path in order to get there. And that's why I enjoy following it, and I always find it very, very expansive.
Oh, cool. Well, let's see. We covered the Emerald Tablet. I want you. You had getting back to alchemy. Did you want to talk about the process of manifestation? This is kind of like what they were doing in The Secret and in What the Bleep Do We Know? And affirmations and things like that. People, as we said, with the new normal, we like to make things practical. And let people know how useful alchemy could be if they wanted to take it up.
The first thing that I'm going to do, I guess in describing this in the amount of time that we have, is kind of give you the Cliff Note version of it first.
We can only
and
give
then
them
I'll go back eight. To the beginning. Okay.
Get excited
the
and then
step.
Join school.
Okay. The first step is what we call calcination, which is a form of spiritual testing. And I'll define that in a few moments. The next step we call dissolution, which can be considered framing. Now, anybody who works in marketing understands what framing is. The third step is what we call separation, but a way of looking at it is also preparation. Then we have something called conjunction, which by and large is just ritualizing. Then the next step, the fifth step, is something called fermentation, which occultists or esotericists call conduction. Then there's the sixth step of distillation, which we can call transmutation. And then the final step is coagulation, which we can refer to as release. Now, in the first step, calcination, spiritual testing, what happens here is that the person essentially goes through the process of burning the self of ego, of projections of thoughts, of feelings, or emotions that are normally perceived as negative. It's a form of reverse engineering, which can include what you learned in today's newspaper, what you learned from religion, what you learned from your parents. But by and large, it's those things that actually contain us. It's what we might refer to as the Western dragon. You know, it confines things of value without really using them because it has a sense of, let's call it, social duty. You know, it's all of the you shall and you shall not rules that society places on us. Okay? That's the first step. And we have to take that through spiritual testing or calcination. We have to find out we by and large already know what the morals of a particular culture are. And that's nice and that's well and good, but what are the personal ethics? Now that's entirely different. Ethics is what a person walks around with. It's what they consider right and wrong. And we all have an innate sense of what's right and wrong. As far as the test goes, that sense actually comes along when we're very young. By the age of three, we understand what's good and what's not. Spiritual testing or calcination actually goes through the process of discovering what is merely temporal and moral and what is ethical, eternal for us. And it breaks down whatever the scenario is. Once we do that, we get into dissolution or framing. At this point, we have burnt up with our minds the pieces of who we think we are. And now we're capable of looking at those individual pieces by adding the element of water, the element of emotions to the ashes of what have been burnt by the fires of spiritual testing. And at that point, we actually begin to invest emotions in what's important and what's not to us personally. And with that addition of the element of water, we can actually wash away those things that do not really help our spiritual growth. Now, what we're left with are those things that are positive and have emotional value for us. Now that we recognize that, we move on to the next stage, which is separation or preparing. At this point, we can actually find symbols for those things that remain with us. And we can begin to use those things as occultists or spiritualists. And at that point, we can set up for the next step of creating our own reality by conjunction, bringing those symbols together, actually doing something with it, beginning to play around with the ideas of who we believe we are and seeing how it works out into this new configuration. Once we've burnt away mentally all of those things that we don't like, once we've washed away all of those things that are negative feelings, we have the symbols, the totem, the telesmes, the loom, as in weaving, of what we wish to be, and now we start enacting those things in the process of conjunction or ritualization. After that, we have a process called fermentation. Once we're in our particular ritual, no matter what it may be, we're now on the adventure. Certain things pop up during the adventure that call us to rise even higher. Let's take, for example, Bilbo Baggins. Okay. He decides to go on the journey with the dwarves. And in that journey, he realizes that now he has to put his life on the line. It's just not fun and games. He is called to a higher level. Now he has to come to terms with what he has to do, because now he is enacting it. But certain shadow elements of the scenario come to light. And this is the process of fermentation or conduction. Once we get through that and we begin to realize what it is, then we have another step which adds kind of water to it again. And this is called distillation or transmutation. Utilizing the flow of emotion from ritual, distillation, sometimes called transmutation, is an additional wash of the parts of the personality that no longer work with the new self that has been uncovered during enactment. That sets us up for the last step, which is coagulation or release. By this time, we're pretty much close to what's called the Philosopher's Stone. It's a soft amalgam, though, during the distillation process. During coagulation, now we've come to terms with who we are, not only to the outside world, but to who we are to ourselves. And through the practice, the continual practice of the preceding six steps, what we believe we wish to be, that ideology becomes hardened. And it no longer is a conscious effort, but through the practice of noetic alchemy and the continual practice thereof, we actually become who we think we are. So now it's no longer a conscious effort. We are that frequency. Now, this is played out all the time when people go through any kind of ritual that really means anything. It happens all the time. But it happens on such a small scale that people don't realize the different sections of the enactment. And they can't take those principles out and then apply them to the larger span, the larger scale of their lives. That's what noetic alchemy does. That's what it's there for. It has broken down these different sections in order for you to have a pathway, in order to make your entire life a ritual, in order to be everything that you desire to be. And that's the alchemical process in a nutshell. I mean, there's a lot more and a lot of exercises and a lot of internal exploration, so on and so forth. But that's
it's a description of life put into chemistry terms.
Yes, absolutely. As long as people do not get stuck with the denotation and understand that it's connotative, it is symbolic, it's like poetry. It means more than just the words. There is a gestalt sum occurring when one goes through the entire process. Something truly divine does come out of each and every step, because in every step you kind of reach that aha moment where you realize now it's time to move on to the next step.
But this is all, I've got several of my previous guests have all said, I believe, if I've heard them correctly, that the point of life is living, that your product at the end of your life, when you die finally, is what have you done with not your environment, but with yourself. And sounds like this is a way of getting, of doing that great work, is to work on yourself and purify yourself.
But also realize that in changing yourself, you also change your environment.
That's
your
true.
Environment, because of news, because of the divine consciousness, responds to you, like the environment responds to you.
And we are all part of a greater whole. So, oh my goodness,
absolutely.
I'm sorry, I have lost track of time. You have been fascinating.
Oh.
But I just noticed that it's almost 9, and we have to get up. Oh, thank you so much, Ariel Sirocco. And we've got the www, the Akashic, AKASHIC Temple, TEMPEL, one word, theakashictemple.com to get to the school. Anything
correct.
Else that people can get in touch with you more?
We are also on Facebook.
On
under Akashic Temple. Come and join me there. And if you go through the website, though, you can reach me directly via an email, and I can send you information when I'm doing classes within the New York tri-state area, because I'm really focusing on developing the school right now. So instead of traveling, which I've done for a few years, I'm keeping it local for the next two or three. But one can always plug in online and see the classes via Skype.
Yay. Okay, well, I'm going to have to rush off.
Absolutely.
Thank you again. And tell all your friends about this podcast.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you, and I hope to see you soon, okay?
Great. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.